down these evildoers and bring them to justice, which is exactly what I will continue to do as your president. Making progress. Two-thirds of the known al-Qaeda leaders have been brought to justice, and we're slowly but surely methodically finding them and bringing them to justice. It's hard work, and we've got some really fine people working hard, really fine people. A lot of them wear the uniform of the United States military. Politicians make a lot of promises, I know, and I've tried to do everything I can to meet them. One of the promises I did make is I said, help is on the way. When I, 2000, Dick Cheney and I were campaigning, we used to go to see the military, go to a military base or talk to military families. Our pledge was, help is on the way. Help's happened. Our military is strong, vibrant, skilled. They're getting paid better. They're getting housed better. They're getting all they need, and that's what they deserve. Listen, as the commander-in-chief, I've got to be able to tell the husbands and wives and the moms and dads, we're doing everything we can. Everything we can to make sure you've got what you need to help us do our duty, which is to protect America. A second lesson in all this business is that when the president says something, he better mean it. In order to make the world more peaceful, the president must speak clearly and mean what he says. I said...
What you've said is enough lies, Boy George. This rhetoric about I'm doing everything I can to make sure that the soldiers have everything they need. Now tell that to the thousands of American G.I. Joe heroes who are sick and shredded up with subpar at best medical care. Who the hell you think you are lying like this? Oh wait, you're talking to the American public. Then you babble on, to fight terrorism is hard work, but we have a lot of fine people working on this in the military. Yeah, I know, and I've seen those heroes work, like at Abu Ghraib prison. And then you round it off saying two-thirds of all known al-Qaeda leaders have been brought to justice. Well, regardless of the fact that these were and probably still are your former allies, after you've gone haywire, they probably got 20 to 30 times more of those numbers now since 2001. So shut the hell up. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, Slave Revolt Time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment, and we're going to deal with some of the issues of the lesser evil from Nader to Kerry and Edwards. And wrap it up on how market capitalism at the end has no meaning of being a lesser evil. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1, Slave Revolt.
They destroyed the world.
The entire Los Angeles area. Already hospital facilities have begun to crack under the strain, and civil defense authorities state that the situation is much the same across the entire country. Martial law is now nationwide.
Major cities in all parts of the country, New York, Los Angeles, report plague victims falling dead in the streets, in their homes, at their work. The first symptom appears to be severe choking, followed by immediate unconsciousness. Death occurs within minutes.
Whether a state of war between China and Russia still exists is not important any longer. Our fellow countrymen are dying. The very foundations of civilization are beginning to crumble under the dread assault of that horror, long feared, germ warfare.
Carlo Rad Channel, this is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes. Those found without specific military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Conrad Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Now the question is survival. Is this the end of technological man? Is this the conclusion of all our yesterdays? The boasts of our fabled science? The superhuman conquests of space and time? The age of the wheel? We were warned of judgment. Well, here it is, here, now, in the form of billions of microscopic bacilli. This is the end.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see where they've gone? They're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets in the solar system.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to start off with is a situation that's been going on. You know, it's kind of like the dismal state of the left and radical opposition in America is apparent by the defeatist positions. And at times, anti-social and anti-democratic strategies that some of these people adhere to try to maintain their lesser of two evil strategy and candidate, which often ends up working in lockstep with, of course, the Democratic Party. We're going to explore some of that aspect of the erosion. And first start off with John Kerry, who was recently on CNN's Larry King show. And Kerry is asked by Larry King about his and Edwards' position on a fair trade. So let's see what Kerry has to say about his views of fair trade. And then let's take it from there. Check this out.
What about an area that appears in disagreement? It came up, I think, in the debate we did in California on fair trade. Senator Edwards opposed NAFTA. He wasn't in the Senate when the vote came up, right. And you're in favor. How will that come down?
It'll come down, I think, very easily, Larry, because we both believe, I mean, the heart of our disagreement or agreement was that workers in America were not being treated fairly, that this administration has abandoned countless people in Ohio and Michigan and in Wisconsin, run around the country. There are workers who just feel abandoned. They've had to unbolt their equipment, ship it to China, in some cases train their replacement workers. And the job training hasn't been there. The health care support hasn't been there. The new job creation hasn't been there. John and I are in agreement that what we need is smart trade, trade that works for all of us. And I think we need to fight in our trade agreements to raise the standards by which other people are living and by which we're competing. That's a worthy goal.
Had a difference, though, right?
Well, it really, in the end, I think it was one of those struggles within a Democratic primary process to find a difference where there wasn't that great a difference. And I think John would agree with you that he didn't like NAFTA. I voted for it. That was the difference. But we both wind up in the same place today, that we have to fight for a fair, competitive playing field for the American worker. And when I'm president, the American worker isn't going to have to beat down the door of the White House to have us stand up to have trade laws enforced on behalf of America.
Was it?
All right, right there you hear Kerry talk about this almost Orwellian speak, talking about he's for fair trade, and but he believes in NAFTA and GATT and a bunch of other things too. But Edwards was kind of against it, but now they both believe in smart trade for a program that's going to benefit all of the workers. This is Orwellian double talk, because this arose the fact that we live in a capital market financial monopoly system that is hell-bent and predicated on maximizing its profits. So smart trade actually means bamboozle the masses of working people out there into believing that you're doing something in their interests, but of course you're maintaining the hierarchical status quo mandate that you are put in place to administer for. So here you have a situation where a key instrument of how these imperial wars keep manifesting in an imperial society. GATT and NAFTA and all of that so-called free trade stuff is all part of the imperial market order, where the U.S. uses its military to help stabilize the rest of the world into positions that are overly favorable to the dominant class in America. So you can't have what they call fair trade, now Kerry's calling smart trade, but you can't have the NAFTAs and GATTs without having wars, because you have to have the school of the Americas so that you have low-wage, high-repression areas. You have to have the 200-plus school of the America-like facilities that are in this country that help train these dictators on how to terrorize their population and maintain order within them. So Kerry is not laying out any different fundamental foundation for these for what is in the foreseeable future than what Boy George is, by the mere fact that he is for an imperial trade policy that favors the imperial monopoly financial class. So what has basically happened is that so much of these liberals and weak type leftists and so on and so forth, pseudo radicals, are so defeated and they're in such decline that their version of a lesser of two evils, which is basically a defeatist policy, is soft sounding capitalism as opposed to ferocious sounding capitalism, even though it's capitalism with the all the destructive ingredients at the end of the day. Now next, Carrie talks about Edward's experience as compared with other bourgeois politicians who are, of course, helping administer policies for this ruling class. So let's see what Carrie has to say about that, and then let's take it from there. Check this out.
Yes, John Edwards has had 6 years as a United States Senator, but he's had a lifetime of experience and judgment, lifetime of fighting for things, lifetime of family life, lifetime of caring. You know, Dick Cheney was only a few years in the Congress, and then he held several different kinds of various positions, some executive, some public. Ronald Reagan came to the office as a governor with no foreign policy experience. George Bush came with zero foreign policy experience and used Dick Cheney as his buffer to say, well, this will be okay. I believe what's important is that I picked somebody with the character, with the judgment, with the values to be able to take over as president and lead this nation if something were to happen to me. I know, from watching John Edwards on the campaign trail, from looking him in the eye as close as I am to you and debating with him and talking things through with him, from watching him in the Senate and watching him work, from looking at his lifetime of battles, this is a man who represents the values of our country, and this is a man strong enough and skilled enough to lead it.
So once again, you have Kerry basically talking about, the so-called experience and what it necessitates to help administer the policies of this country. And on a certain level, he's right. Especially nowadays, with the lack of serious, ferocious clash resistance, you don't need the same type of policy administrators for the ruling class to be as experienced and as technically savvy as maybe some of their past little icons or whatever, because of so much of the deterioration of class consciousness and class combativeness amongst the people, where they've had these various ruling classes in this country and around the world historically on a razor's edge. Basically, you have a situation now where you can see the lack of need in some ways by the ruling class circles to even expect those people who play presidents to be very sophisticated and sharp on a lot of issues. You now have a president, a current president, Boy George, who in years past wouldn't have been able to cut the grade because of the fact of the different types of competing social forces that were in existence and striving for the masses of people's hearts and wills. So you had situations going on in China. You had situations, whether they're viable or not is a different thing, but at the more people were in motion, China, Latin America with Cuba and stuff. You've had, the anti-colonial stages going on throughout Africa and Asia, and those movements that were developing, and the capitalist class is trying to compete, especially in America, for the hearts and souls of the people, to think that colonialism and capitalism are not intertwined. So you've had to have people like Kennedy, who would try to bamboozle, and who did bamboozle many people in Africa and Asia into thinking that Sam was not what he, of course, was. So they set up various programs, like Peace Corps and all of that type of stuff, to give the good face to capitalism. At the same time, you had Kennedy, you know, set up the Green Berets and those types of entities to combat the guerrilla movements that were taking place in Latin America. And he did this after he read Che Guevara's book, Guerrilla Warfare. In other words, Kennedy was just as much of an imperialist as Boy George is. That's not really the issue. The point is that at that time, with all of the different social, economic, and political issues going on, you had to have more intelligent administrators for the U.S. imperial ruling class interests be on top of it. You just couldn't have a Boy George bumbling and fumbling around. So the Boy George syndrome, and actually his administration's boldness, is really a reflection in part of the lack of political firepower of the various oppressed classes under the ruling class's thumb. And so when they get into these little, you know, almost mystical discussions about is Edwards qualified with his experience, is Boy George qualified, da 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 da, basically it's this gumbo talk, because all they really need to do is be savvy on being beholden to the various lobbyists, powerful lobbyist interests, and and follow the chain of monopoly command, because so much of the left has deteriorated on the class combative atmosphere that they don't even need administrators, unfortunately, at this time, to be sharp on those particular questions and techniques. Now, next, Larry King asks if Edwards' trial lawyer experience is a strike against them. So let's see what Kerry has to say about this question, and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
The fact that he's a trial lawyer, a deterrent?
No. On the contrary, I think that it's an asset in skills. Again, people make a mistake about that, you know. There's a young girl, Victoria Lakey, who today is taken care of, who has medical care for the rest of her life, who needs it because of something terrible that injured her grievously. And were it not for the skill of somebody representing that kind of person in America, which is one of the beauties of our country, people might not be taken care of. Now, are there abuses in the system? Yes. John Edwards and I both believe that, and I'm committed to trying to help fix that. So we're going to surprise people in our ability to show, I think, common sense and a direction which helps to undo the things that are wrong, but preserve the rights and the important things that make a difference.
All right. Once again, you see how things have been really screwed off its hinges, off the tracks. This is how you know how far things have deteriorated. When because, see, like, the lawyers, quote-unquote, have a bad image. And that is if it's lawyers who are taking up cases against corporations who have violated, you know, so, like, if a corporation knows that their cars explode if you hit them 30 miles an hour from behind, and they've hidden those facts because they didn't want to do the type of changes that would be necessary because of it basically cutting into their profits. So things like this leak out and have leaked out historically, you know, whether it's Pinto cars or whatever. So then people get lawyers and do a suit against them or a class action suit. So this raises up the ire of those who are, you know, defenders of corporate dominance in every specter of our lives, and kick up flames about it. And then the argument ends up being an argument about are people getting too much money for settlements from corporations that are, you know, destroying people and having tires blow up in the middle of the, you know, freeway and stuff like that. Or should there be some kind of torque reform cap? Now, the reason why I mention this is that, and why I say this shows how bad things have gotten distorted, where someone could ask, is this thing, is someone's background who's been a trial lawyer, is this a minus against them? You have a situation right now with all of these, with bad meat. Tons of bad meat each year has to be disposed of. Many of the cows that are, you know, coming out of these fast food, hamburgers that are coming out of these fast food chains, I'm really stretching it calling them cows, considering the fact that many of their diets consist of eating manure, blood, the fat of other animals, newspaper, sawdust, and then being jacked up with growth hormones, which increases your chance of getting cancer because it increases your insulin growth factor, which doesn't mean that you will get cancer, but it increases the possibility of you getting cancer, along with injecting over 50% of the antibiotics that people consume is through eating these types of animals who have all these antibiotics injected in them because they live in these crowded factory farm, you know, subhuman, sub-animal housing conditions. And now you have a country that tests less than 1% of the cows that are consumed to see if they even have mad cow. These types of issues should not even have anything really in a sane society to do with being able to sue these corporations. The questions that should be in the foremost of people's minds at this stage of the game should be fierce debates and strategies to deprivatize and deconstruct the monopoly capitalist order that is obviously in opposition to having any forms of developed, sustainable lives for humans or any other species. The mere fact that you can have a situation where these corporations on all the different levels of our lives are not only on the immediacy destroying human lives, but are making the planet more and more in hostile to the living conditions of all living forms. The discussion that should human beings have the right to privately monopolize and have a capital system order on these industries and what have you, that should be the question of the day. But things have been retarded so bad that just the basic minimal discussions of having people get a few crumbs from these corporations that have destroyed them and or their loved ones' lives, that becomes somehow the question of great controversy and a means of even restricting those become the question of the day. Once again, that's just another example of how far, often we don't even see it like that. Often it just goes right before our eyes because we get caught grinding over some of the basic crumbs without challenging the whole order that is maintaining a condition that is destroying human and other life. There's no way in hell that a food industry, along with other industries, but just the food industry, for an example, and meat industry and all of that, which every step you could see is destroying workers who work in the factory, you know, these meat industry guys who are working in these dangerous conditions with giant machetes, working 100 miles an hour. They're getting chopped up and destroyed, injured all the time. You got people who live downwind from these factory ranches, you know, pig ranches and all of that. The way these things are set up and conditioned, those people are getting sick because of all the poison that's being fed these animals and the high toxicity of even the waste that comes out of these animals. The people who are eating these flesh products are getting sick and sicker, and we see the seeds of catastrophe with various forms of mad cow and other diseases on the horizon, etc., etc., etc. We have all of these different examples at every stage of just the meat industry alone. I'm not even talking about some of the other food industry with the GMOs and all of that madness. And yet, the it's controversial, quote unquote, to discuss getting some kind of crumbs from someone who has, you know, caused you to be gutted because you've eaten some of this slop. That's, once again, an example of how far things have regressed in class consciousness and class active militancy in this country. But next, let's move on to the so-called spoiler candidate, Ralph Nader. He was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman recently. And here he discusses some of the safety regulations in the car industry that he successfully helped get in place. And let's hear what he has to say on that issue and more or less combine it with what Kerry was saying, as you just heard. So let's check it out like this.
Did this, that provided the momentum for the first historic regulation by the federal government of the auto industry, requiring life-saving standards to be installed, like seat belts and later airbags and padded dash panels and collapsing steering columns and better braking systems. And that has saved over 1 million American lives, many more lives abroad, because the foreign manufacturers had to meet the same standards to enter the U.S. market, and millions of injuries reduced or prevented. That really taught me just how far these corporate executives would go out of their way, knowing that their engineers knew how to save hundreds of thousands of casualties a year, but they still wanted to sell cars for horsepower and style rather than for safety. Now they're advertising safety.
Okay, so once again, Nader, who basically acted as, you know, a lawyer similar to Edwards, you know, as a history of putting in regulations and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not arguing against in any way, of course, of fighting for regulations and all these other things that are obviously humane. But in essence, what I'm saying is that once again, you heard Nader talk about the car industry that had to be dragged kicking and screaming to just put in modest things like safety belts and all of that. Now, in a truly radicalized society, the question of the day would have been, then obviously the privatization of transportation can't be left, once again, in these people's hands. And now, on the car issue, we went through the meat and so on and so forth and all of that, but the car industry and this thing is a similar situation where they've intentionally tried to basically lock people in their cars. They've intentionally, the car industry has helped derail people from being in public transportation. You know, just like even on the Bay Bridge in the 40s and stuff, there was a railway system that used to take many people across the rail, across the Bay Bridge. It was the car industry in collaboration with the petroleum industry that helped stop that public transportation access, thereby putting more cars up on the road and across the freeway. And then, of course, then they turn around, as we've seen, and raise the rates for crossing the bridge, which is just another form of taxes. So in every way, you see them manipulating. At the same time, more people in cars is creating and helping increase the global warming conditions that we see taking place on a planetary scale. And this is in part locked into the private capital monopoly, almost manifest destiny, profit mentality that this country is locked in and tries to maintain to the point where you hear Nader talking. And while, like I said, the issues he was talking about were correct as far as, you know, safety belts and other safety things that he is worked for, but at this stage of the game, until we take it to the point of stripping the power out of the capitalist hands to even be in position to determine what we have to fight over concerning reforms, then we'll continuously be in a cycle of reform politics and trying to basically deal with not only legislative, you know, electoral little politics on a lesser or two evil nonsensical strategy, but our basic lives. When we're stuck in a mode where we're discussing the food we eat, and we have to have big, major organizing to just have basic things like food labeling in place and make even concessions on that, as opposed to not having food labeling, that's a lesser of two evils strategy because that we're caught in, because that's still a strategy of reformism, which I'm not against in the context of where we're at now. But in essence, what I'm saying is that at the end of the day, we have to take the power and control out of the private sector capitalist domain's hands, because everything we'll be doing in our lives will be centered around basically trying to crawl up the hill while they're creating these landslides of capitalist destruction. So in essence, what I'm saying is that like the meat industry and many other things that we talk about on here, this is just another indictment of the private ownership industrial system that we live in. This shows how vile it is, and that our true emancipation is not going to come in the form of some kind of lesser of two evils strategy or lesser of two evils candidate. Now, next, Amy asked Nader about the statements he said about the AIPAC lobby and its puppets in Washington. He said this to some Muslim activists in a speech. So let's check out what Nader has to say, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
I wanted to ask you about questions, comments of the head of the Anti-Defamation League objecting to what you have said about the White House and Congress. You were speaking to a gathering of Muslim activists on Capitol Hill at a hearing entitled The Muslim Vote in Election 2004. Said, I don't think there's any prospect of the two parties differing in any significant way on the Middle East. The Israeli puppeteer travels to Washington, meets with the puppet in White House. He then goes down to Pennsylvania Avenue and meets with the puppets in Congress. The Israeli leader then, quote, brings back millions of dollars in aid to Israel. It's time for the United States government to stand up and think for itself, you said. ADL National, Abraham Foxman, the ADL National Director, said, we write to object to your characterization of the White House and Congress as puppets of the Israeli government. Reasonable people can and do disagree with U.S. policy related to Middle East, specifically U.S. support for Israel. However, there's a line between thoughtful reason, constructive disagreements, and offensive hyperbole. Your response?
Well, I've said that on more than one occasion. In Washington, it's the old Roman saying, res ipsa locator, the thing speaks for itself. Of course they're puppets. They pass these resolutions with over 400 members of Congress because the AIPAC wants them to. There's no independent thinking there. But in response to Mr. Foxman, I'll quote him, Tom Friedman, on the February 5th column in the New York Times, when he said the following. This is Thomas Friedman, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of books on the Middle East. Quote, Mr. Sharon has the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat under house arrest in his office in Ramallah, and he's had George Bush under house arrest in the Oval Office. Mr. Sharon has Mr. Arafat surrounded by tanks, and Mr. Bush surrounded by Jewish and Christian pro-Israeli lobbyists, by a Vice President Dick Cheney, who is ready to do whatever Mr. Sharon dictates, and by political handlers telling the President not to put any pressure on Israel in an election year, all conspiring to make sure the President does nothing. That's end quote. Those are the words of Thomas Friedman. So maybe Mr. Foxman wants to take it up with Thomas Friedman. The truth here is that there's no balanced determination. The U.S. government never connects with the deep and broad Israeli peace movement that represents members and former members of the Knesset, former military people, former intelligence people, former mayors, existing mayors, professors, rabbis. They put 120,000 people in the square in Tel Aviv recently. You would think that the U.S. government was not a puppet. It would support the deep Israeli peace movement, which has been in touch with the Palestinian peace advocates and has worked out more than one accord where there can be a two-state solution living in peace with a viable, independent Palestinian state. So there should be a debate. The two candidates, Kerry and Bush, are both pro-Israeli military government. They do not connect with the Israeli peace movement or Peace Now or Jewish Voice for Peace or Michael Lerner's Tikkun group. Both Kerry and Bush are pro-war. Our candidacy with Peter Kamejo is the only anti-war candidacy. We have a proposal to engage in a responsible six-month withdrawal from Iraq, pulling out our military and corporate occupation of that country, having internationally supervised elections so there's no puppet government. And those policies will separate the mainstream Iraqis from supporting or sympathizing with the insurgency, which is spreading. That's the only way to do it. You do not say to the mainstream Iraqis that they're going to be faced with an endless, if not permanent, military and corporate occupation by the U.S. with a puppet regime and get peace and stability in that war-torn nation.
Now, when Nader says that you would think that the U.S. government is not a puppet and all of that, you know, these little clowns who are administrators like Kerry and so on and so forth, of course they're puppets for the service, of the global capitalist market military industry. A corsair puppets to the ruling class. The U.S., they're in the U.S. government to serve those global interests. This is just an illusion, a reformist illusion, that these clowns are in there to serve some kind of greater purpose and higher order. That's just, that's how you get caught up in fake nationalism, that you're an American citizen and America stands for, you know, this nation stands for, you know, all of this hocus pocus founding fathers, you know, imagery and stuff. So then that quite naturally means that the people who are on serve in the government hold these principles and values. So if they see something going wrong or something that are against human rights, that they would be against it. And if something is stopping them, like AIPAC, then there's some kind of contradiction. No, we just went over. It's not just AIPAC and a little Jewish lobby and all of that type of stuff. The way the thing is structured, you have, as I mentioned before, went over about the meat industry and the undue influence that they have. Well, how do they have it? In part because of the meat lobbying industry, which is tied in to the meat industrialists, the capitalists within that system. So this is how you can get Oprah Winfrey slapped aside her head when she had the guy on debating one of the meat industry spokesmen about what's going on in the meat supply, and she said she wouldn't eat a hamburger again, and then they filed all these lawsuits, and she started backtracking, and they took her to court, and even though she quote unquote didn't get fined in court, she's never been the same on those types of issues again. She was disciplined. They took a lot of their commercials from her show, or the money that they would use, that they would donate for commercials and things of that particular nature, so on and so forth. So you have the meat industry that has, of course, undue influence. The overall GMO food industry that is basically creating these Frankenstein plants, and the ramification of what is going to happen down the road to the people who eat these plants, the soil and the food, the animals and insects that eat it. Who knows? But for them, who cares? It's all about their profit now. So you've had we have an empty ocean where the fish lobbying industry has overfished and helped pollute just about every commercial fish you can imagine, to the point where one blue tuna in Japan sold for over $140,000, one fish. And that's because the way the market order works is that the in a sane society and world, you would have a situation if you see that you're depleting a particular entity, like a fish or whatever, you would pull back the reins. But in the market order of things, the capital market order of things, that fish becomes more valuable. So the fishermen are actually fishing these fish down to the very last one. Because the fewer fish they are, the more valuable they are, and the more precious economically they become to those who follow that market order. So we've seen all type codfish and all of these other fish. The industry has been destroyed. And they can't blame it on anyone else, meaning the capitalists, except themselves. That's a microcosm of what they're doing to the planet and the world in general. We have global warming by fossil fuels and other industries taking place. Yet, the oil barons and their lobbyists keep the world economy locked into this dead energy system. Even though there's other living energy systems that have long should have been more advanced than where they are now. I'm talking about solar, you know, the sunlight, that's living energy, and wind power, another living energy. But here we're they're still we're still locked in to a dead energy system, fossil fuels, because of the market order and market dominance of a capitalist class. Now, what these things have helped lead to, like the fossil fuel energy, are the same types of wars and imperial military thrust to maintain control of other people's oil under their feet. That's tied in to this whole thing that's going on with Israel and the Palestinians in the Middle East. So it's not just one little thug, lobbying system and all of that that's having undue influence. The way the market order is set up is for them to have undue influence and to put as much space to the influence that the masses of people can have over directing and controlling their lives. And the only way that that can be transformed is not by voting in one bumpkin servant, has a D on his chest or a G on his chest or R on his chest or anything, this is this hocus pocus. The reality is that if the Democrats were a true alternative from an ideological standpoint, from a platform standpoint, from a movement standpoint, in the real sense, the ruling class would have long been in full-scale attack. Now think about all of these movements that are going on, various social justice movements and other movements against the war, anti-globalization. Everywhere you step, you see from the Panthers and historically on down, the FBI, COINTEL program, the state do a full throttle assault and attack on those movements because of their opposition and the role that they play in trying to address grievances and bring about some forms of alternative way of acting out those grievances and thinking about those grievances. These clowns don't attack the Democratic Party. They're not any real. That shows the falsity of the lesser of two evil concept. This is all mysticism. This is rhetoric. The Democratic Party and all of them are just spokes in a wheel. And anyone who proclaims a reformist policy is also a spoke in that particular wheel. So when Nader, quotes Friedman's quote about how these guys are all bide and tied up, it does not underscore that this whole thing that's going on in the Middle East and in Israel and all of that is part of an economic order of U.S. imperial dominance and the role of Israel playing that. The Israeli situation is tied up into global imperial policies. Even back when the British, during the war, made a deal. They made a deal with the French about having access and, influence in that region. They made a deal with the Arabs, and they made a deal with the Jews. They made a deal with all three entities at the same time. All three deals contradicted one another, and they did it because they were looking out as an imperialist administrator for their particular global interests and stuff. So allow yourself to get caught up in the power of a particular lobbyist organization and how we need to, quote unquote, or in Nader's case, those in government need to stand up, you know, and all of that type of rhetoric, when that's what they're there for. They're there to serve those orders, those market lobbyist orders and stuff. And but next, let's check out how Amy takes Nader back to the 2000 Republican National Convention. And some of the questions that were asked Nader and some of his responses as they were at this particular convention. So let's check out what they got to say. Dig this.
To go for a minute back to the year 2000, to the Republican convention.
We're coming closer to the podium of the Republican National Convention. We'll see if we get in here.
I see a lot of purple.
Sir, some states you're drawing at 7 or 8%. Do you think, would you be the spoiler if this race is close?
You can't spoil a political system that's spoiled to the core. We need a new political reform movement in this country. It's not going to come from the Democratic or Republican Party.
So, Ralph Nader, you were just on the convention floor of the Republican National Convention. Cheney is going to be speaking. George Bush is being nominated tonight. What are your comments on George W. Bush of Texas?
I think he's a conglomerate corporation running for president disguised as a person. I don't think there's ever been a candidate since McKinley who represents big business so faithfully and tries to manipulate images in order to appear like he's for the people.
Ralph Nader, tonight you have gone onto the convention floor. Dick Cheney is now speaking, the vice presidential nominee and CEO of Halliburton, the largest oil service company in the world, also former minister, also former secretary of defense. What about that combination of military and corporation?
Well, I think he's going to represent big business. He comes from big business. He just displayed some of the forked-tongued rhetoric of the Republicans by saying, quote, no more shirking our duties to the elderly, end quote. Does that mean he's going to have tough government Medicare negotiations to bring down drug prices? Is he going to protect Social Security, or is he going to turn the billions of Social Security over to Wall Street firms or big supporters of the Republican Party to invest in and destabilize Social Security? Is he going to protect elderly people from all these consumer scams? So you see, it's just rhetoric. You know, they're telling people what people want to hear, but they're not giving people what people want them to deliver. And that's a forked-tongued politics based on cash register symbiosis with big business interests.
Now, and you heard Nader talk about what we need is a new political reformist movement. See, that hits the nail on the head of what he's all about. At least he's honest about that. He believes in a reformist movement. Now, in these degenerating times, even that, in many ways, is considered too radical. It's not a real alternative, which I'll get into in a little bit, but because it's not really needed at that time, and I'll get into that a little bit also. In essence, what I'm saying is that when he talks about, though, at the same time, if you can't spoil a system that's spoiled to the core, he's not talking about the origins of it. He's just talking about undue influences that he sees that have taken place, which of course have, but in reality, they're more tied to the destruction of militant class action in this country and around the world. And in that deterioration, you've seen the monopoly class in this country become more and more emboldened in the same way that they have been able to step up their brutal, bold attacks, even on some of the most flimsiest of claims Panama, Grenada, so on and so, you know, Iraq, of course, Afghanistan. That's a more of a reflection, essence, what a NATO strategy is. It's a strategy of holding on to the tail of the dragon. And, of course, from time to time, the dragon is going to break free. And, of course, over a period of time, you're going to get tired and become less and less likely to hold on to the dragon under that type of quote-unquote restraining tactic, to the point where the dragon just runs amok. The strategy, in essence, is to slay the dragon. That's the only way to get from up under this type of stuff. In essence, what's going on is that Nader is like the 1930s version in Germany of a social democrat. In other words, it was the social democrats in the 1930s in Germany that basically saved capitalism from being destroyed by the militant workers in Germany. And they helped save it and helped return it with the aid of a Stalin and them's buffoonery to the capitalist class in the form of handing it over and letting the Nazis seize the time, who operated as shock troops against the masses of people, to basically docilize and subjugate the majority of Germany people, so that instead of the class, the working class masses of Germany seizing the time and beating down fascism and capitalism, Hitler and them basically played their role by helping finish off the working class so that the capitalists could come in at the end of the day and play a role in containing him. Thereby, much of history of class action from that period, not all, but much, has been distorted, because instead of the working class masses finishing off capitalism in this very industrialized country, and finishing off fascism and having it, the masses of people finishing off the state in essence and being in control, instead of that happening, you ended up having the capitalists be able to step in later on and help contain and restrain an entity that they helped create and develop to smash the working classes in Germany. So it ended up being a defeat for class consciousness worldwide, because they were able to give this mythical D-Day story. They were able to then expand their imperialist grip without concern of a society where more fervent class conscious people were in place. You basically had a demoralization and stuff. The reason, but basically in essence what I'm saying is Nader is kind of like the social democrats of the time, who basically were a reformist group when the capitalists in Germany had been discredited and had showed that they had no place governing the lives of the masses of people in Germany. The social democrats came in with all these reform policies and all of this type of stuff and helped give them breathing room and help placate the issue along enough with a bumbling Stalin for the shock troops to come in the form of fascists and finish off the fiery conflict by the capitalists. The problem that's happening now for Nader is that the masses of people in America are not in a fiery combat class conscious mode. and the U.S. Empire is not in that form of crisis itself. So they don't need Nader. They don't need a false prophet coming in, trying to disillusion the masses about the reforms, soft capitalism. let us all get together and hold the tail of the dragon. And that way, that's the technique and strategy that we need to have a better life. Because since they're not in the type of crisis, and since the masses of people aren't in motion in this country, well, hell, they can just act a fool. They don't need Nader to play that role. So the disrespect, in a sense, that he gets from, you know, the little twin parties and the ruling class overall is because of the situation that we're in. When things ratchet itself up in the future and people are throwing off the blinders about the market capital system, its financiers, the monopoly system, the hegemony that they have over dictating our basic lives, etc., etc., and the crisis that all capitalist systems spin themselves into from time to time, then Nader, if he's still around, or a Nader-like character, will be more than welcome to help come save the day, at least for a little while. Now, next, Nader is asked about his association with Michael Moore and the apparent flip-flopping that he feels Moore has taken. So let's see what Nader has to say about this, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Ralph Nader, last election, Michael Moore supported you. He is definitely throwing his support now, calling for support for the Democrats and throwing out George Bush. Your response?
I don't know what's happened to Michael. I mean, he's made a very successful film. All good luck to him. But, you know, one year he's for this candidate, another year he's for that. He endorsed Wesley Clark in New Hampshire. And then he said something about he wanted to take our votes away, imagine that, to Kerry. And then he says falsely that I promised in 2000 not to campaign in the close states. Which is not true. He campaigned with me in the close states right up to 2 days before the election. He was supporting us in the giant MCI Center rally in Washington, D.C. So I don't know where he is politically anymore. I thought more highly of him when he was a challenger, a resistor, when he defied the political system. And he's got to sort out his own political positions more clearly.
Okay, in essence, what has happened to Moore is that his mind, in many ways, and I'm not talking about you could still do good artistic things. This is a problem of confusing one's artistic talent with their overall understanding of the world. Michael Moore's lesser of two evils strategy has basically, in many ways, turned his mind into mush. You know, had the strategy that the Democrats were a lesser of two evils. And then he got frustrated with that temporarily and said that he couldn't see the fundamental difference between the Democrats and Republicans, which was, you know, a start on the right course. But then thought that he can go to another reformist, a 1930s Germany's a social democrat reformist in the form of Nader, and think that would be an alternative. So then, which of course is not a real alternative, then Boy George gets into office, and by the developments of the economic order, within the world economy, the decline of competing nations and systems, the boldacious U.S. empire has been flexing its muscles more and more violently as time progresses, and in different forms. In many ways, as I've said before, the violence comes in different forms in by these monopoly militarist capitalists. The number of people who died during Crime Bill Clinton's administration still surpasses the number of people who've died so far under Boy George's administration. Yet many Democrats don't see Crime Bill Clinton's administration as being the type of imperialist domination of another country and people as they do Boy George's, because many of them are these liberal types that if they see boys and girls go over with little boots and rifles in hand and then come back in caskets and this type of classic occupation type of way, then that represents the horror of wars in its most immediate form. Yet Crime Bill was still doing illegal flybys or no-fly zone bombings like once every 3 days. He maintained these genocidal, yes they were, sanctions, and where over 500,000 kids alone perished during his little time slot. At the same time, they were bombing up water supplies and other things that were illegal. And all of this was basically ignored by many of the liberal types and Michael Moore types that are crying now. During the meantime, he was still his administration at the behest of the CIA and other agencies for U.S. global dominance, were still maintaining links and ties to some of their terror network apparatus, the Mujahideen and Osama and all of that. They still had good links. They were faking like they weren't, but they were still using those guys in different locations throughout the world, as documented facts prove out. But Boy George's administration goes into an occupational mode with the boots on the ground in force. This shakes up more to the core, and he doesn't look at Crime Bill help pass the baton to the next administrators for the ruling class, because during Crime Bill's administration he helped weaken the situation for the Iraqi people, the human material, the psychology of the people, so on and so forth, just the basic economics and health of the people, so that when these cowards wanted to take it to the next stage, many of the people in Iraq were ripe for some of the next stage of the onslaught. This is not a lesser of two evils. These are two people on the same team, track team, passing the baton from one to another. Boy George's recent actions shook Michael Moore's mind up so much that now he's retreated even more into a lesser of lesser two evils type of minstrel mentality, to the point where now he can't no longer differentiate between one party and the other, or now he does differentiate between one party and another, and declares that even his little pseudo support for Nader can't be qualified anymore. This, once again, is nothing more than a deterioration of many of these people who claim they have, you know, humanitarian concerns and outlooks and so on and so forth. When all of this type of stuff has happened, and it's like last week where I went over all of the different things that Kerry has been down for. He voted for the war, you know, the Iraq war. He was down with that. He voted for GATT, for NAFTA, so on and so forth. He was down for the Patriot Act, you know. He's down with Crime Bill Clinton's Effective Death Penalty Anti-Terrorism Act, which was basically the stepchild to the Patriot Act, which was just another form of handing the baton to the next administrators for the ruling class. So after all of this type of stuff has been done, and you have people's minds gummed down in this capital market order, in a retreat of real radicals challenging this whole electoral nonsense in the first place, you have people allowing themselves to be reduced to debates about Kerry and Edwards discussing one of their now favorite words, which has historically been a favorite word of the conservatives, the word values, as the corporate media even gets into the discussion as they mention this over and over and over again. This is what I mean. Check this out.
I got better values than this, because values are something you live in, the choices of your budget, in the people that you choose to help, in the things that you do, in your energy to lift America and take it to a better place. Values are what you do in every day in American politics.
Values is not part of a political slogan. Values are what's inside you. What you believe in, what you fight for, what you care about, what you've shown through your life experience.
Now, this is sending Bush supporters up the wall, primarily because last night the John Kerry, John Edwards ticket was at a big fundraiser in New York City at Radio Hall, filled with celebrities, where off-color jokes were told, and the president really got a beating. One of the things that was said by Chevy Chase, an actor, Clinton plays the sax, John plays the guitar, and the president's a liar. Also, at that same event, John Mellencamp, a singer, who called President Bush, quote, just another cheap thug that sacrifices our young. So pretty rough stuff, Judy, at that Radio City Music Hall event. The Republicans say, wait a second. All this talk about values, and John Kerry gets up at the end of this Radio City Music Hall fundraiser and says, you all really represent the values of America. So taking great exception, the Republicans, to this, saying this sort of off-color, there were some off-color jokes from some of the comedians at Bush's expense. So the Republicans sort of stirring this pot at the moment, saying, well, you can't talk in the daytime in West Virginia and New York and New Mexico about cultural values and not have said a word about what went on last night.
Holding them accountable, in essence, for what these entertainers are saying in their presence.
Right, exactly. And pointing out that Howard Dean, I know you'll remember, also in New York, had a fundraiser where there were some comedians telling some pretty raunchy jokes. And he said, look, we can't have this sort of thing. So.
Now, once again, this exposes how bad things have deteriorated. You have a situation where the other day, or a little while ago now, Boy George, this punk got up there in front of his little friends, and he goes through this skit about, you know, we still haven't found weapons of mass destruction yet, you know, and then he looks under, are they there? Are they over here? Are they over there? You know, and all of this, and the little crowd is laughing, because they knew that this was all a ruse, and it was all just, you know, a joke, and the fact, though, that lives are being being destroyed at that very moment of him clowning and buffooning around is just symbolic of how much disdain that they have for the masses of people throughout the world's lives, not just the Iraqi people, but the little G.I. Joe John Waynes and Jane Waynes that are getting their ass shot off. over in a land they shouldn't be in the first place, unless they were helping the resistance. But see, this is not considered bad taste. This is not considered someone who's making statements that lack proper values, because people know who are tied within the system, including carrying them, that the smirk and laughter that was going on by the people in that room was really not so much in the crude joke that Boy George was laying out, but the crude joke of them laughing at us. That's who they were laughing at. They were laughing at us being dumb enough to think that there is some fundamental difference between them and their buddies in the other lobbying room, the Democrats. They're laughing that at the masses for thinking that many of them think that Nader is somehow some kind of alternative. They're laughing at the fact that people get caught up in these little, words like values and all of that, where people have been so chauvinized that that they think that it's their clique only that has proper values. And then it goes from their particular clique and those who align themselves with that particular clique to their particular nation. Meanwhile, the corporate financiers who are pimping the masses of people in this nation and throughout the world are doing basically what Boy George and his little elite group were doing, chuckling. Well, it's in essence time to take that smirk off their face with a dagger, in essence, in their heart. And you can't do that holding on to the tail of the dragon. Hold on a sec.
I was on my way to a Broadway show on March 20th when my roommate and I decided to stop into a restaurant, an Indian restaurant or a South Asian restaurant, for a quick meal. As we sat down and began eating, a few seconds later, approximately five people looking like they were NYPD with their bulletproof vests on and their guns pointed started yelling, "Get to the back of the restaurant, get to the back of the restaurant." I, of course, hesitated, being quite nervous, and they screamed, "You better get back to the restaurant," pointing guns at me and the other patrons in the restaurant. As I sat down at the table that they were motioning to, I looked around and noticed there were about 6 to 8 other men in the restaurant, all of South Asian descent, besides myself and my roommate. After sitting us at the table, they pointed the gun right in the face of the worker for the restaurant, the waiter or the manager, and stated, "Is there anyone else in the restaurant?" He motioned to the kitchen, And the policemen walked over to the kitchen, kicked the door open with their fingers on the trigger, and after a few seconds and hearing a commotion, the five Latino men who were working in the kitchen crawled out on their hands and knees. And again, the police were pointing guns at them. They sat them at an adjacent table to me, and we were all sitting on these two tables now in the back of the restaurant. Following this, the police continued to kick open doors, closets, to the bathroom, remaining with their fingers directly on the trigger. It was not locked. I definitely believe they could have opened the door. What it seemed to me was they were heightening the situation by kicking and believing there could be someone hiding in there, and then kicking and immediately throwing their gun in front of them. I was frightened. Everyone else in the restaurant was frightened. The whole entire restaurant and all the other people in the restaurant were very frightened. Walked down the stairs following that, and about eight of them, sat in the front of the restaurant now, and they took out their computers and started to type frantically. Whatever they were typing, I do not know. And two other people walked over to our table, said they worked with the Homeland Security Department. He showed us a badge that said INS on it, and asked to see our licenses and our wallets. My roommate and I said we wanted to leave. We wanted to leave right now. We were just having dinner. There was no reason to hold us. And they explained that you are being held in a Homeland Security investigation, and explained that they had the right to do this under the Patriot Act. As they then asked for our licenses, I, knowing some of the rights that we supposedly have in this country, or at least pre-9/11, the passage of the Patriot Act, I asked to speak to a lawyer. And the INS official, or the Homeland Security agent, stated to me, you have the right to speak to a lawyer, but the lawyer will need security clearance before they can speak to you. When I asked how long that would take, they said it would take maybe a day, maybe a week, even up to a month. So obviously, after hearing that, and though, of course, quite frightened, I continued to give my license. Now, you asked earlier, were there people frightened in the restaurant? Well, they can ask everyone for their licenses. Many people had them. Some people were not carrying any forms of ID. One man who worked in the kitchen did not have any ID on him. And when asked, then what is your date of birth? What is your date of birth? In a very harsh tone from the Homeland Security Department officials, he started to shake frantically. I believe he also was not able to understand much English, being Latino. And he stated only March 20th, 2003, March 20th, 2003, over and over, which was the date of the raid. That just explained to me how scared people were in this restaurant. After receiving my license, I live in New York, lived in New York for 6 years now, but my family lives in Colorado, and my driver's license is still from Colorado. One of the officials came up to me and asked me why I had a license from Colorado. I explained just as I did to you. And one of the policemen pointed a finger at me and said, this man's hiding something. So they took my licenses back to the people at the computers, and they began to type information from the licenses. At that point, I continued to press for legal counsel, knowing or believing that this was my right. One of the people who was at the computer then walked over to me and put her finger right in my face. I could still feel the breath when she yelled at me on my face now. And she stated, we are at war. We are at war. Don't you understand? We're trying to protect you. We are at war.
We are at war. And the war is not going to be resolved holding on the tail of the dragon with other reformists and other spin masters of reality. The only way to blast our way out of this concrete jungle of capitalist filth and death is to slay the dragon. And then if you want to have the tail for dinner, Well, that's up to you. Until the next time, slave vote. Out.